We have come to Daniel chapter 10, and Daniel chapter 10 is sort of like Daniel chapter 9 in this regard. The vast majority, well, all of chapter 10 is introduction to chapter 11. There isn't any prophecy particularly. I mean, there's a few prophetic statements in chapter 10, but the vision that chapter 10 is leading up to actually starts in chapter 11. And if you remember in chapter 9, the whole chapter was given over to Daniel's prayer, confession, and all of that as prelude to verses 24, 25, 26, and 27, the end of the chapter. And I think that that's extremely instructive because prophecy as a thesis or as a theme or as a topic of study has always been real popular. People are interested in knowing prophetic things. In fact, if you claim that you are studying prophecy, people come listen. But it doesn't seem to have the kind of intended impact that it's supposed to have. Because if you'll remember, the material for the Gentiles in chapters 2 through 7 had a lot of prophetic stuff in it, but the core of that whole section was chapters 4 and 5, which had to do with Nebuchadnezzar's conversion and Belshazzar's death. So what we're actually seeing is that God gave prophetic information, but he didn't do it to satisfy our curiosity. He did it to meet some specific needs we have to be able to relate to him in a way that's pleasing in his sight. So if study of prophecy doesn't move us to more careful consideration of our daily interaction with God and with each other, then it's fruitless. It's basically a waste of time. And that's, you know, I've said this many times, but Isaiah's apologetic, and Isaiah's the big heavy book in the Old Testament. It's like Romans in the New Testament. It's the big heavy theological thing. But his apologetic was, in his setting, that you have to relate to the God who is the God. And the question for them in a polytheistic world was, well, which one is the God? And that's the same kind of thing we run into today with Islam claiming Allah's God. And, you know, the question is answered in Isaiah constantly by this statement that if you run into somebody who can tell you ahead of time the way things are going to be, and especially some short term, because without the short term you have no way of gauging it, but some short term prophecies that come to pass exactly like they were made, so that you have confidence in those prophecies that stretch for hundreds if not thousands of years. But the whole point of that is so you'll know who God is, so you can relate to him. It's not just to satisfy our curiosity or our, you know, our desire to know what the plan is, because we're very much like Nebuchadnezzar. Now, that ain't the way it's going to be, and we'll build our own 90-foot-tall image. So, chapter 10, in that respect, is another one of these chapters where the focus is on Daniel's prayer and fasting and his attitude and all that kind of thing. And the whole chapter is given over to the angelic messenger coming and laying the groundwork for Daniel's understanding. But Daniel's understanding, well, if you'll notice in verse 2 and 3 of chapter 10, Daniel's in a deep funk. He's been in mourning for 3 entire weeks, and he didn't eat any tasty food or meat or wine. He didn't anoint himself. He was in a deep funk, and his prayer and fasting lasted for 21 days. And we'll be talking about why that might have been a little bit. But my point is, this angel came to Daniel because he was in this funk. He needed some answers. And the angel, the angelic messenger, came to tell him, to lift him out of that. So that's the prelude to our study of 10, is that it's another one of those passages in Daniel that emphasizes what's really important. And that's our relating to, we claim as Christians to be relating to the eternal God, infinite in all his ways. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist to realize that we're talking about somebody who's beyond imagination. both in immensity, because the creation is bigger than we can even imagine, and in the specificity, the details, because every detail, every molecule that's vibrating, every detail is under His oversight. I have this theory that human beings have been created with an immensity above them that is matched by the smallness below it. It's kind of the old thing, do fleas have fleas? It's how small does it get before you get down to the smallest small. And they're talking about quarks and all this stuff that's so tiny that if you were to compare the smallness of the small to the large immensity of the large, it'd be about the same. We're kind of in the middle. So, given a God like that, and being able to know that we're worshiping the right one who is that way, because He's shared prophetic utterances that have covered not only days and weeks and months, but hundreds and thousands of years, with a precision of accuracy that's just absolutely phenomenal. We talked last time in chapter 9 about the prophecy of the 69 weeks that led up to the cutting off of Messiah. And that was so precise that it's 173,880 days. And it's exact. The math is exact. And so is the history. So that you know, the Jews hadn't gotten that. They hadn't figured that out in their understanding of the scriptures. They hadn't come to grips with exactly what that. But there was this anticipation that Messiah was to come. So there was this messianic expectation in the first century. And of course, when John the Baptizer came on the scene, they began immediately to speculate as to whether he was the Christ or not, because they had this Christ-focused expectation. Part of that was because of the prophecies. And those guys from the east that came on testimony of the star, we've seen his star in the east, and we've come to worship the King of the Jews. They were right on target. And all those Jews that knew the scriptures, they didn't even have a clue. Well, they knew where it was going to be born because the king asked them, but they didn't know it was time. So, in chapter 10, it starts out with the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia. Now, Dr. Ryrie, in his study Bible, puts that at 536 B.C. Well, 536 B.C. was exactly 70 years from 606 B.C. when Daniel was carried off into captivity. In chapter 9, we read that Daniel had read 2 years previously, in the 68th year of the 70 years, he had read in Jeremiah that it was going to be 70 years, and that is what sponsored his prayer confession in chapter 9. So here we are 2 years later, and it said in at the end of chapter 8 that there was no one to explain the vision of chapter 8. Chapter 9 gives somewhat of a timeline, and in chapter 10 it says that Daniel understood. Verse 1 says, a message was revealed to Daniel, who was named Belteshazzar, and the message was true and won a great conflict, but he understood the message. That's the introduction to the revelation in chapters 11 and 12. So by the time we get to the end of chapter 12, Daniel knows what's going on. He understood. He didn't at the end of chapter 8. And I'm not sure that the time frame in chapter 9, it clarified some things. And let me say this about the prophecy of the weeks in chapter 9. We have said several times now that the general prophecies covered humanity's existence or history from Babylon to the Messianic kingdom. And it sounded like in the prophecies that it's just going to flow right into it. And it did flow right up through the 69th week. That was all 173,880 days of one day right after another. But when chapter 9 said that after the 62 weeks, which was after the initial seven, so after the 69th week, that after the 69th week doesn't just allow us to have interruption between the 69th and 70th week. It requires it. It doesn't allow, it requires it. The 69th week was going to expire. Messiah was going to be cut off. Well, in order for Messiah to be cut off, there's a very strong probability that that meant he had to be identified as Messiah. Well, on the 173,880th day, he was recognized by the nation as Messiah by the triumphal entry. And they were all waving palm branches and lining the street with palm branches and their clothing. And they were uttering the words that referred to their confidence that this was the Christ. And 5 days later, he was cut off, but not for himself. But the point is, the next prophetic statement in the 69th, after the 69th week, is that the people of the princes to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. Well, you have to remember that Daniel is getting this information, and the city and the sanctuary have already been destroyed. And now he's being given a prophecy that after this period of time, the city and the sanctuary would be restored, which means automatically that the city and the sanctuary had to have been rebuilt. So over this period of time, of course, it even says that in the first seven sets of seven, the city will be rebuilt in troublesome times with plaza and moat, times of distress. That's Ezra and Nehemiah. But the key thing is that there's this huge theological misunderstanding after the shift took place between Israel and the church. There's a whole lot of people that believe Israel finds its real fulfillment in all of its promises in a spiritualized Israel now called the church. It's called replacement theology, where the church is the fulfillment of Israel's promises, and so you shouldn't look for a literal fulfillment of these prophetic utterances, because God spiritualized, he's spiritually fulfilling them in the church. Well, that's just nonsense. Words have to mean something, and you have to find out what they mean, and sometimes their meaning isn't straightforward because it's metaphorical or hyperbolic or something, but the fact is the context defines all of that. So when we go into this information about the time and all of that, keep this in mind. The numbers are always the numbers. When it says there are four heads, that signifies four kingdoms. When it talks about ten horns, there are ten horns. When it talks about four kingdoms before Messiah's kingdom, there are four. The numbers are always the same. So when you get to like Revelation, it says that he will rule and reign for 1,000 years. Well, a lot of people who disagree with my orientation here say, well, that just symbolizes a long period of time. No, it doesn't. It symbolizes 1,000. Numbers in Scripture do have a non-numerical significance. For example, the number 3, it signifies sufficiency. 3 and sufficiency don't have any direct relationship except in numerology. But there's a reason why Paul quit praying for deliverance from the thorn in the flesh after the third time. Third time's a charm comes as a colloquial expression of the idea that 3 times is enough. And even Leah, when she had her third son, now my husband will love me. I've given him enough sons to bring it about. It didn't happen. But she believed that sufficiency thing. So, it's a long way into chapter 10, verse 1. But there's a question here in terms of the fact that he's actually talking about the very year when the 70 years of Jeremiah's prophecy had been fulfilled. And he says, a message was revealed to Daniel. Now, he's in Cyrus the Persian's empire now. Darius the Mede and Cyrus the Persian were two of the kings that Daniel went from Babylon into, the Medo-Persian empire. Well, Babylon's history. So what's he saying? Who was named Belteshazzar? That's a throwback to chapter 2. And the question is, why is Daniel writing in Hebrew to the Jews? I mean, technically, he's writing to his own people. Why does he remind them that he was named Belteshazzar, which is a throwback? That's one of the issues. And he says the message was true, one of great conflict, but he understood the message and had understanding of the vision. So that's one of the first issues. This third year of Cyrus, according to Ezra 1, verse 1, this Cyrus made a proclamation in his first year to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. And he says specifically in Ezra 1:1, to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah. Okay? So that was 2 years prior to the expiration of the 70 years that he made this proclamation in his first year. And some people think that's the fulfillment of the commitment that the firm covenant, where he's going to make a firm covenant because he's going to rebuild the temple. But the command, or the issue of rebuilding, was for the city and the sanctuary. This decree was just for the temple being rebuilt. So this one doesn't fit the words. And then in chapter 2 of Ezra, it gives the number of the people who actually left Babylon to go back to Judea. And the numbers are almost 50,000. There's 42,360 returnees, and they have 7,337 servants among them, and that adds up to just under 50,000 people returned to Jerusalem. And Ezra and Nehemiah are the historical record of that period of time. And if you remember, Malachi's complaint to the people was that they had, in Ezra, they had had to stop the building of the temple after the foundation was laid. There was some objection, and some of the adversaries sent a request to the king to stop the building until he'd researched some things, and, you know. But anyway, they stopped it. Well, they never got started again. They let years go by. And then Malachi, around 450 B.C., somewhere along in there, rose up as a prophet and says, is it time for you guys to be sitting in your fancy multi-storied fancy houses and the temple of the Lord is just, the foundation is laid? And that's when he goaded them into going ahead and getting the temple started up. So, we have the numbers in Ezra 2. Then in Ezra 3, they started the offerings, but they didn't have a temple yet. They tore down the temple had an altar that had been torn down by the Babylonians. So they gathered up the stones and stuff, and they built an altar, and they started their offerings again at the place where the temple was going to be built. And then in chapter 3:8, and that FF after the 8 simply means following, 3:8 and following, they laid the foundation of the temple in the second year. And then in chapter 4, verse 24, the work on the temple was forcibly stopped. And like I said, this is 536, and Malachi came on the scene about 450. So, a long time, over 100 years later. We lose sight of the time frame that's involved here, because if you remember, Daniel got a vision in the third year of Belshazzar, 11 years before the end of the Babylonian. And then, before that, he had this handwriting on the wall thing to be done. That was at the end of the Babylonian thing. And then you had the first year of Darius, and then you have the third year of Cyrus. So there's a lot of time going by. And Daniel's written the records down of what he's seen and been told, but he's waiting. He's not waiting days or weeks. He's waiting months and years for the rest of the information to come. And he didn't get it all until this event, chapters 10, 11, and 12. So that's the significance of that third year of Cyrus, the culmination of all of the prophecies that started back in chapter 2 are going to be wound up in chapters 11 and 12. And then he reminds his readers that he was formerly known as Belteshazzar, which is There's an extra syllable in there from Belshazzar, but technically the words mean pretty much the same. And you have to wonder, why does he mention that, especially in light of verse 2 and 3? Because Daniel has been mourning for 3 entire weeks and he didn't eat any, you know, tasty food or drink. And he didn't anoint himself until 3 weeks were completed. And he didn't even stop at the end of the 3 weeks because he had chosen to do this for 3 weeks. He had started it out in the... Verse 4 says, on the 24th day of the first month was when he saw this, the beginning of this vision. Okay, if that's the end of the 3 weeks, then it was on the 3rd of the first month that he actually decided he'd go into this fasting and prayer. And you have to remember that for Israel, the first month was when they had the lead up to the Passover. So you have this very significant month of Israel's history. And one of the big things, the Passover, the big thing was God's deliverance of them out of Egypt. Well, now he sent them back to the land, so he's delivering them out of Babylon. But for some reason, Daniel's in this funk. So the question is, what did he remind his readers that he had been known as Belteshazzar signify? Well, I don't know for sure, but I do know that the last thing Belteshazzar did as a Babylonian was interpret the handwriting on the wall, and that was the initiation of the transition from the kingdom of the head of gold to the kingdom of the chest and arms of silver, or the lion kingdom is gobbled up by the bear, the devouring bear, Babylon and Medo-Persia. And this reference had to hearken back to either chapter 2, where he was renamed, or chapter 5, when he read the handwriting on the wall. But the reference for his Hebrew readers is actually tied to the great conflict that he understood and had an understanding of the vision. It says in verse 1, a message was revealed. Well, that word actually literally means was stripped naked. And the imagery there is that there had been a lot of information given to Daniel, but it was kind of shrouded, clothed in mystery. And you remember that as Belteshazzar, he told Nebuchadnezzar, there is a God in heaven who reveals mystery. So this reference may actually be a reference to the fact that his people need to be reminded that he functioned as a spokesman for the God who reveals, and this is exactly what's happening here. He's stripping the fog away from the information that has left the fog because the information's incomplete. So, it's true, but it's a long time coming. He got that first vision, 3 years after he was carried into captivity, so about 65 years, 67 years before this period. That's a long time to wait for clarity. Anyway, he said it's true, but it was a long time coming, and it was understood by Daniel, and that's on the heels of the prophecy of the 70 weeks that had been laid out just prior to that. So once he got the information in chapter 11 and 12 and was able to plug in the 70 weeks prophecy, it says, okay, now I got it. I understand. So by the time we end up 2 weeks from now, we should be in the same shoes. Now, in relation to the initial vision, in verses 4 through 9, on the 24th of the first month, this vision was introduced by an extremely intimidating person who looked like a man. So I just put the word man in quotes. This would have typically been 10 days after the celebration of Passover. And since Daniel had begun his fast 21 days early, he must have begun it just after the month began. So we have that issue of the celebration of God's great deliverance, and now we're 70 years after the captivity, so we have this other deliverance where God lets the people go back to the land. And the problem is that the building of the temple was a wish. The foundation had been laid in the second year of Cyrus. But we're in the third year now, and there's so much opposition, there's no progress. And some people might think that that was because that was the reason why I was in mourning. But I have a little bit different idea. The description of the man that he saw, he lifted up his eyes in verse 5, and there was a certain man dressed in linen, whose waist was girded with belt of pure gold of Uphaz. His body was like beryl. His face had an appearance of lightning. His eyes were like flaming torches. His arms and feet like the gleam of polished bronze. And the sound of his words like the sound of a tumult. Now, if you read Revelation chapter 1, when John hears this voice behind him and he turns to see, the image in Revelation chapter 1 is enormously parallel. Not exact, but there's an enormous parallel here. And I just wanted to point out some of the issues that are involved in these descriptive terms. Because he says he was clothed in linen. Well, linen is typically the clothing of the priests. They were supposed to be garbed in fine linen, white and clean. And the issue of the loins girded with fine gold in Revelation is the golden girdle. But that's about the loins. And that's typically an image of protecting your manhood. That's where you put your protection so you can't get ruined. And imagery there is that this protection is gold. And you remember in the prophecy about the head of gold, this is an imagery of deity. This is God involved in this whole issue here, because the King of Kings was Nebuchadnezzar as the head of gold, but Jesus is the real King of Kings, and he's got gold in his garment, chapter 1 of Revelation. Well, this person here has gold around him too, around his waist. And then his body being like beryl. Beryl is it's mostly hidden because he's wearing linen, but the stone that was called beryl was on the high priest's breastplate. That's how they decided who was guilty of certain things. They'd have the priest, you know, they'd pass these people by and one of those stones would either vibrate or light up or something. Something would tell them, say, okay, it's from that tribe. And then they'd have them pass by and it was from that family. And, well, this whole issue of beryl is Zebulun. And the issue of Zebulun was, according to the prophecies about Zebulun, was the expression of the inner spirit where you had this tremendous vitality to do. So here we have this image of a man who's very capable, enormously capable. And his face has the appearance of lightning. Well, in the Revelation, it's as bright as shining, like outshining the sun. And then his eyes, like flaming torches, just almost exactly like Revelation 1, piercing eyes. And the arms and feet are bronze. Bronze is a symbol of judgment because they made the altar that took the sin offerings out of brass or bronze. And his words were like the sound of a tumult. Well, that sound was what caught John's attention in chapter 1 of Revelation. So we have a parallel presentation here, but we know that this is not Jesus. And the reason we know it's not Jesus is because he tells Daniel a little bit later in the chapter that he was sent on the first day that Daniel began to humble himself and pray. But he got caught by the prince of Persia. And the prince of Persia withstood him for 21 days. And that's why Daniel had to pray and fast for 21 days. He didn't know that he'd been heard on the first day. He'd been like me and I knew that. Well, that's been the end of that fasting and stuff. You know, but he didn't know because he couldn't see behind the veil. But this person couldn't be Jesus, or the prince of Persia would have never had a chance to stop him for 21 days. So we know two things about this. Number one, he is an angelic messenger. And number two, his appearance is the appearance that he represents the God of the Jews, particularly the God of Zebulun. Now, also goes on and says in verse 7 that Daniel was alone because the men that were with him didn't see it, but they felt a dread, a great dread, and they ran away to hide. Have you ever been in a situation where the hair on the back of your neck just stands up and you think, oh my, and you have no real reason for it except oh my? Well, that's kind of the way it was here. These men didn't see this vision, but the presence of this man that was talking to Daniel, even though they couldn't see him, they could sense him. And they were scared stillless. They took off. Now, when we get to verse 8 and 9, he says, I was left alone and saw this great vision, yet no strength was left in me for my... It says, the New American Standard, I think, mistranslates this. It says, my natural color turned to deathly pallor. And I retained no strength, for I heard the sound of his words, and as soon as I heard the sound of his words, I fell into a deep sleep on my face, with my face to the ground. John passed out too in Revelation chapter 1 when he saw this. Same imagery. But the King James says that his comeliness turned into corruption. Well, now that might refer to his natural color turning to deathly pallor, but I don't think so. Because if you'll remember, back there in the introduction in verse 2, Daniel is in mourning. He is grieved. And he's not eating or drinking enough, more than enough just to stay alive, this fasting and prayer thing. He's not eating tasty food or wine, and he didn't anoint himself. So he's probably significantly weak physically. But the physical weakness is the outcome of a grief that is driving a deliberate period of fasting and prayer that is caused by his mourning. And the question is, what is he so bent out of shape about? What is he so upset about? And I think that he explains it in the sense that verse 8 says, King James says, my comeliness turned into corruption. Think about that for a minute. And then he says in verse 15, when he had spoken to me according to these words, I turned my face toward the ground and became speechless. So another human being appearing person showed up and touched his lips so he could open his mouth. And he said, oh, my Lord, as a result of the vision, anguish has come upon me and I have retained no strength. For how can my servant of my Lord talk with such as my Lord? There remains just now no strength in me, nor has any breath been left in me. So, he's talking about a deep-seated anguish, mourning. And the question is, what is it? Well, I want to make a couple of connections that you may or may not agree with. Number one is chapter 9. When Daniel heard that the prophecy of Jeremiah said it's going to last 70 years, and he was in the 68th year, and he knew that they were in Babylon because of their sin, he began to confess his sin, the sin of Israel, his participation in all of this. And I really believe he meant it. I don't think he was just mouthing words. I think that Daniel was just absolutely dismayed by the rebellion that existed in Israel that caused God to send them into Babylon. They were so callous and so idolatrous and so hard-hearted and so disobedient and unbelieving that God had to actually eject them from the land. And Daniel felt a participation with him. Now, I think that's what he meant when he said, my comeliness has turned into corruption. Because I think what he was saying there was, all the ways that I thought of myself that were halfway decent all of a sudden turned into pure crap. And that's the result of what happens when you come face to face with the reality of the glory of the God that has spoken and expects us to trust him and walk with him, and you know. And Israel had this God dwelling right in their midst. He was there in their temple. The Shekinah lit the temple up. He dwelt right in their midst, and he was beyond good to them. And yet they wouldn't obey him. They wouldn't pay any attention to him. They disobeyed. They every time they turned around, they were doing something they should not have been doing. And Daniel felt like, yeah, and I'm the same way. That's part one of part one. That's the first connection I want to make, but there's another sub-connection in light of that. Do you notice it says in verse 11, O Daniel, man of high esteem. And then another one says, verse 19, the other guy that touched him so he could talk, he says, O man of high esteem. Why do you have to be told twice that you're held in high esteem by angelic messengers and or the God who has sent them? Why do you have to be told that? Unless you have felt like you just have totally unworthy. It's like Isaiah in Isaiah 6. He sees the Lord high and lifted up, and all of a sudden he feels like, I am a man who lives in the midst of a people of unclean lips, and my lips are unclean, and woe is me, and we've all had it, and there's no excuse for any of this, and this is horrible. I think that's the reason. Daniel is sensing his depravity in the light of the glory of the God who has done all these good things for Israel and has now even allowed them to go back to the land. And he is in mourning because it came to that. The second connection is one that it just dawned on me the other day. When Jesus was going into the Garden of Gethsemane the night he was betrayed, he took Peter, James, and John and went a little bit further away and asked them to pray. And his reasoning was, my soul is grieved unto death. And the question is, why? Well, not only that, he was going to have to take on the sin of humanity, but I really believe that Jesus' soul being grieved meant that he was going to enter into a period of separation from his Father that had never happened in the history of God. And it meant so much to him that he just could not imagine his soul being abandoned by his Father. He was grieved beyond measure. And Daniel, in a very real sense, is saying, look, guys, as Jews, as the people chosen by God out of his pure grace, we ought to feel, we ought to sense this abandonment by God when he has to discipline us because we won't listen to him. And you know, people, we seldom really sense the grief of the abandonment. Because God, Jesus said, I'll never leave you nor forsake you. And he meant that. He does never abandon us. But there is a breach in the fellowship. And people say, it's no big deal. And that's bad. Because I think that's what's driving chapter 10. Daniel is so distressed by the depravity of humanity, particularly Israel's, in the face of the glory of the God who has blessed them beyond measure, that he is just distressed, and he goes into this prayer for 3 weeks, prayer and fasting. And he's already been told in chapter 9 that it's going to be a long, long time before all this is worked out. There are 70 weeks of years prophesied on your people, and no matter how you slice it, that's half a millennium. And if there is that breach between the 69th and 70th as an indeterminate amount of time, then it's going to stretch on beyond that. And as we know from looking back, it's stretched out over 2,000 more years. So I really think that what's going on here is that Daniel realizes that the problems of humanity under sin are enormously significant. It even takes God, if I can say it this way, a long time to work all this stuff out, detail after detail. So that's what's going on. I think that's why he just can't even face the guy. He turns his face to the ground and he falls into deep sleep, and then the hand touches him and he says, Daniel, you're a man of high esteem. You're a man whom God loves very much. Understand the words that I'm about to tell you and stand upright. I've been sent to you. And when he spoke this word to me, I stood up, trembling. And he said in verse 12, don't be afraid. From the first day that you set your heart on understanding this and on humbling yourself before your God, your words were heard and I have come. The problem is, verse 13, on my way, the prince of the kingdom of Persia was withstanding me. He didn't want me to get to you. He didn't want me to bring this message to you. He didn't want you to understand the vision. So he tried to block me, and he was effective for 21 days. And I was just there, stuck. But Michael, one of the chief princes, and of course in chapter 12, verse 1, it says that Michael was the chief prince of Israel. Michael came to help me, because I'd just been left there with the kings of Persia. So here's Michael. You know, I don't know where all the other angels are. There's a whole host of them, but apparently they're busy. And he says, I've come to give you an understanding of what's going to happen to your people, but he says, in the latter days. The vision pertains to days yet, long time down the road. And then when he said this, my face turned toward the ground and I became speechless. And another human looking being touched his lips and he opened his mouth and spoke and said, I can't talk to you. I don't have any energy or strength. How can I talk to you? There just is nothing in me. No breath has been left. And so he touched him again to strengthen him. He said, you're highly loved. Don't be afraid. You're highly loved. I think that's something that we need to take a deep breath on occasion and just relax in. We're highly loved. Even when our depravity is weighing us down. God already solved that problem at the cross, and His love has not been shifted at all. He says, don't be afraid. Peace be with you. Take courage and be courageous. And as soon as He spoke to me, I received strength and said, okay, you've strengthened me. Now you can talk to me. Verse 20, do you understand why I came? I shall now return to fight against the prince of Persia. Now, this fight against the prince of Persia business, Daniel is pulling the veil, or having the veil pulled away, so that he can see the principalities and powers in the heavenly places involved in warfare, conflict over what's going on the earth. And the princes of Persia, the angels that are involved in the history of Persia's activities, you remember the book of Esther? That was during the Persian period. What happened in the book of Esther that was so dangerous for the Jews? They were fixing to get wiped out. Yeah. So, this fight with the prince of Persia, the princes of Persia wanted to wipe out Israel. And they didn't want Daniel as a prophet of Israel to tell anybody anything about any of this. They wanted it kept from them. And the reason is because they wanted to destroy the nation. Well, he says, I've got to go back and fight with him again. And so I'm going forth, and behold, the Prince of Greece is about to come. Now, about to come, this is 538. The Prince of Greece doesn't come until 333, somewhere along in there. All right, we're talking 200 plus years. So, we lose the perspective. We think that we can read through the book of Daniel and all this is a short period. It's not. His life spanned the 70 years. The prophecy spanned the 70 years. He didn't get the clues until the end. And then the prophecies were for times that were hundreds of years into the future. He said, I'm going to tell you, however, the writing of truth, what's inscribed in the writing of truth. And there is no one who stands firmly with me against these forces except Michael. And, of course, in chapter 12, when Michael stands up, Katie barred the door. So, we'll get to chapter 12 in a couple of weeks. But the point here is, up until this point, we haven't really been given much in terms of a prophetic vision. This has all been introductory. But the introductory part has to do with Daniel's funk because he is wallowing in the depravity that has caused Israel to be in rebellion against God, which he's confessed in chapter 9 in lots of words. And he sinks into this depression, this grief, and he decides the way to handle it is to fast and pray. And he starts, and God sends this angelic messenger, but Daniel doesn't know he's been hung up for. So he just keeps on fasting and praying for 20 more days. Finally, he shows up. So this is what chapter 10 is about. It's just an introduction to this great vision of conflict that's going to be unveiled in chapter 11.